Welcome back to the Fried Egg Podcast and part two of the Bilcour interview. If you missed part one, check it out on our website, iTunes, or Stitcher. Thank you to all the listeners who submitted questions. While I couldn't get through all of them, I tried to touch on the vast majority throughout the conversation. If you're new to the podcast, be sure to subscribe to our channel on iTunes and Stitcher. Now, here's part two of our conversation with Bilcour.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
So to switch gears to another side of yours, and this is a question from one of our listeners, Carr from the course, or for the course. He asked, when you originally finished Warren, the Notre Dame course, there was no par on the scorecard. And what was the thinking behind that?
Well, Andy, that truly is like, you know, it just, that came about out of a sort of a humorous comment that I made. We were just finishing the course, and I was out there with Brian Godfrey, who at the time, and for quite a number of years after the course opened, was the golf director there. And Brian made the comment that the then golf coach at Notre Dame questioned how the second hole could be a par four and the 10th hole could be a par five when the second hole was longer than the 10th in terms of actual yardage on the scorecard. Now, if you play there, yeah, you know, the second hole's flat, it goes out there, and it was built to be a long four, big opening in front. 10th hole goes kind of cascades down that hill. It's got the creek that winds in front of it, and a much more severe green. So anyway, but Brian was saying, this has come up more than just from the golf course. We're getting ready to open. We're going to print the scorecards, and we're doing all this stuff. He said, what do you say to that? And I went through the thing, why the second hole? This, and then I sort of flippantly just said, I said, well, Brian, you know, does it really matter? I mean, it basically is, you're going to play the hole regardless of what the par is, and you're going to put down a number after you played it. You know, so what difference is it? I said, for that matter, you can just put no par on the scorecard, and no one will ever know. Brian, he laughed. And the next thing I know, they decide, well, let's try this. We'll put it with no par on the scorecard. Well, needless to say, you can imagine the uproar that created. So that all came out of just I wasn't really being serious about not putting any par on the scorecard, but I've seen scorecards, you know, with no par on them. So that's what the heck.
My whole thing is par doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It's just a made up. So it's a psychological test.
Well, it's like when we did all that work at Pinehurst number 2 a few years ago. Mm-hmm. Mike Davis, USGA, you know. Mike summed it up perfectly because there was this discussion going on about changing, prior to the 2014 opens there. The fourth hole had been a par 5. And the 5th hole was a par 4, probably the hardest par 4 in the world. And Mike Davis' idea was, let's make the 4th hole a really long 4 because the entrance to the green is so much more receptive from a really long 4. And the green on number 5 is so severe, let's build a new tee for 5 way back and play 5 as a par 5. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, this went against things that had happened there in previous U.S. Opens. It was quite internal controversy.
Yeah.
But Mike summed it up perfectly. He said, I promise you, he said, all the players in the championship look at this at 9.
Yes.
These two holes together, 4, 5, it doesn't matter. It's 5, 4, 4, 5, they're counting. If they walk off here with 9 on their scorecard for the two holes, they're happy. They're going on. He said, so however you want to think of it, it's 9. And he was absolutely right.
Then, 1-2 at Riviera, 14-15 at Sandhills. I mean, yeah. They're all over the place.
Yeah. And, you know, if you look back, people say, well, they worked that way for the, you know, the previous opens there, number 2. Well, they, when Ross completely redid the course for the 36 PGA Championship, they were both par 5s. So, you know, it's, I guess it's all relative according to time and place.
So, outside of Old Town Pinehurst, which you've gotten to do restorations of, what site or what course that you've restored has been that course that, like, the longer you spend on it, the greater appreciation you have for it?
I don't think there is one, Andy. I mean, it's, you know, not only have we been extremely fortunate with regard to sites to work with for new courses, we've been very fortunate to work in some really neat old courses. And I'm not going to sit here and start to give you a rundown of those courses, because it sounds horribly self-serving. But we've worked at some truly, truly special golf courses in this country. And it's much like earlier conversation when you go to one of them, you go, wow, this is unbelievable, this is fantastic. And then you go to another one, you go, oh, wow, this is equally good. And so what you try to do, or at least I think what we try to do, is appreciate each one for what it is and try to understand each one for what it is and what it was meant to be. Mm-hmm. So
is that how you approach the restoration work, is you know, not just putting everything back, but discovering the intention of what?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You're trying to take yourself out of the picture. And you're trying to do the work in such a way that if the person who, or people who did it in the beginning came back, you know, they might just nod in approval. I mean, when we worked at number 2, of course, in Pinehurst, it was a huge change, both visually and how the course played, and all Ben I could do. Toby Cobb, all of us who were working out there, we just hoped that Mr. Ross, if he came back, you know, not that he's going to applaud, but at least he would be in approval. That this is as close as we know how to get to what our sense is he must have intended. And, you know, the same thing at other places that we've worked in. You don't go there to leave your signature. You go there to try to recapture something that was.
Mm-hmm. It's the restoration. I'm excited to see more and more come, because there's so many places that if you could get it back to that original feel, you know, from where it's gone, it would make golf a lot better in a lot of places.
Yeah. Well, it can be extremely difficult. It can be extremely political. Mm-hmm. It's, just since we're talking about Pinehurst, but you think about when Ben first went there, Don Pageant, who was the president of Pinehurst, and Bob Dedman, the owner, they just said, we would like you to restore this golf course. And I remember the first question we had, restore to what? This thing has changed its character so much through all these decades. Well, restore to what?
Yeah.
Which Pinehurst number 2 do you want to go back to? Mm-hmm. And in the case of Pinehurst, it was possible to restore to the most, what was perceived to be Pinehurst number two at its very best. Mm-hmm. There are some places you simply could not do that anymore. And not, you know, not just because maybe they've been, now there are thousands upon thousands of trees, but sometimes there are houses, they're different, there's different infrastructure, there's different, just technology. So many things have changed that, you know, that it's just simply not possible to put it back.
We talked earlier a little bit about the pro game and how it gets very, you know, hit it straight, hit it close and narrow. And this year they'll have Byron Nelson at Trinity Forest. What are you expecting from that tournament? It's going to be a lot different, right, than the typical tour course for the most part. But, you know, do you think the feedback from players can be positive?
I think it will be extremely mixed. I think it's going to be all the way across the spectrum. I think there'll be some players who will very quickly appreciate it like it. I think there will be some who very quickly will very much not like it. And it's just different.
Yeah.
Andy, it's different. It's different for Texas. It's different for the tour. It's a different presentation. And anytime something is different, there's, you know, it's certainly open to a vast array of interpretations as to whether that difference is good or not good. So all we can say is we've done our best to present it in a way that we think would be interesting, you know, for those players, the world's best players, as well as the members and the people who play there. We tried to create a golf course that gives a lot of options for them to make their own decisions of what's going to happen. There's Trinity Forest. I mean, I think the very longest players on tour can go there. It's not like we've said you can't hit your driver as far as you want. Mm-hmm. You know, by the same token, I think we believe that given the firm conditions that we hope will appear during the tournament with the turf, that not that there are any short players on the tour anymore, but it could be a situation very likely that the longest player in the field could go there and think, I can win here. And the shortest player in the field could go and say, I can win here. And everything in between. So it's going to allow a lot of choices to be made by players as to how they want to play, how far down the fairways. You know, fairways are wide by the tour standards, extremely wide. And they can choose to play it however they wish. I don't think you will hear, sometimes you hear comments like, well, it's whoever putts best that week. You know, or it's a putter's golf course. I don't think you'll hear that. I think it's going to be more a matter of, there are times there that to be successful, you may have to play a different approach to the greens than they might normally play. It's not a point A to B to C golf course.
It'll be interesting. So many people are based around statistics now on tour, and the strokes gained method is like, oh, if you're in fairway this far away, you know, you've gained this many. But I think playing very good architectural courses any good architecture, you can be in the middle of the fairway and be in one of the worst places.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is going to be the really riveting thing, is that the right play might be to hit it way right with an iron off the tee versus hitting a driver up to 40 yards. And that, from 40 yards, you might have the worst spot of all of them.
Yeah. It will be very interesting to see. Andy and Casey Koch, the superintendent there, has got the turf, the old one now, Zoysia, which is the closest thing to Zoysia in terms of, closest thing to fescue in terms of playing characteristics, how the ball chases once it's on the ground and your ability to putt from off the greens. this is always the closest thing to fescue I've seen. And Casey's got it really keen. And if the weather is good, the wind blows a little, hopefully not too much, because it's totally exposed. But wind blows a little, and it's dry. And again, that's a very big if, because May in Dallas, Texas is historically, I think, the wet, just a horrible month for weather. So we'll see how it goes. But
I think some events have been like, I think there was an event a couple of years ago in May in Texas that like the whole course was flooded, so they converted a 4 into a 3.
It's, I'm telling you, it's a tough time of year there. So, but if the weather's cooperative, and I think it'll be very interesting to see. But it's you're going to get a lot of mixed reviews. We by no means think everybody's going to go out there, oh, this is fabulous, we love this. You know, it's gonna take some time. I mean, it's the fifth hole there, a little short par 4, goes slightly uphill. There's a big bunker out there on the right, short of the green, probably 25 yards. So short of the green. And then the green is tiny, tiny little sort of L-shaped green sitting there. No bunkers around it, but it's just perched way up, crowned off severely like a Pinehurst green. Shortcut grass in front of it, right of it, behind it, left of it. And, you know, I'm sure people would go look and say, well, this is going to be a piece of cake for these guys because they can drive this green. It may be 305 yards, maybe. But the key to that hole is that big bunker is hopefully positioned just properly to the point that all the players on tour, I think, can hit over it. Mm-hmm. The thing is, hitting over it's not the primary objective for those guys. It's hitting over it, but not going over the green.
Yeah.
So to get a ball, for them to just whale one over there, over the bunker, easy. Now they're going to go over the green. Yeah. And if you go over the green, I don't care who you are, Houdini is going to have a hard time getting up and down, and maybe getting up and down in 3 from back over the green. It's just all mowed fairway, it's tight. But now you're trying to get the ball up on this tiny little hubcap thing up there. And if you're not careful, you'll have a John Daly experience. You're up there and back, up there and back. And
playing ping pong.
Exactly. And so the key thought process would be, how do I get over the bunker, but barely?
Yeah.
Just barely over. So when I hit that ground that's just over, it carries me up onto the green, not over. Mm-hmm. And so that's the type of stuff, and you'll see that kind of different presentation, not just that, but presentations throughout the course, that those are the kind of decisions they'll have to make. And I think some will embrace that, and some perhaps won't. You know, I was there actually this past Tuesday for a golf writer outing, and one of the Texas golf writers was telling me about he had spoken to Jordan Smith not long ago and said, Jordan, you know, Jordan plays out there. It's basically become his home course, and his teacher, Cameron McCormick, teaches out there. So you might want to bet on Jordan, you know, come May. He knows that course better than anybody. But he said Jordan was talking to him and saying, you know, the course just gives you a lot of options. You just have to make a lot of decisions. And a lot of times those decisions go really well, and sometimes they don't. And according to the golf writer, Spieth told him, he says, I've played out there. I've shot 6 under par on this course. He said, I've also shot 6 over. Mm-hmm. You know, so to us, see, that's interesting golf. When one of the world's best players says, I have to think about where I'm going to play. You know, maybe I'm a head driver on all of them. Maybe I'm a head driver on some, maybe not. It's a process of them learning how they want to go about negotiating the course. And then, of course, if you have different wind conditions,
different way, different pins, holding it completely different with a different pin.
Right. So
that's the interest in the game.
I don't know, but
it'll be. I'm saying it's like my Super Bowl. It's gonna be. This is the event I'm most excited about in 2018. Let's get to this. I got a bunch of listener questions, and we'll get a couple of these. I don't want to take up too much of your time. Jason Wade wants to know, what do you wish the average golfer understood better about architecture?
Probably how the ground influences play and how the detail work that goes into the creation of the golf course is there to help you in many ways, as opposed, not it's, you know, the perception is there, architects go lay out course and they create all these hazards to try to challenge you. Well, that's true to an extent, because without challenge, golf loses its interest, much like you said earlier about playing tennis straight down the middle of the court. But really interesting courses allow you to succeed. They give you a challenge and they present a situation, but they allow you to succeed. And oftentimes it's the way the tilt of the ground is, or the way the green sits against a certain slope, or is angled. It's often the small things. We all want to notice the giant features, the big magnificent earthworks and that sort of thing. But the detail is the things I think we notice so much, Andy. It's so important. It's a contour that's 6-8 inches high in a green, in a spine that runs down the green, can dictate play all the way back to the tee if the hole presents itself in a certain way, allowing you to play to the right of the fairway, left of the fairway, or whatever. If you can tell where the pin is, oh, it's on the right of that little spine, it's on the left, oh man, I've got to play over here, over there. And those are the type of things we find so interesting.
I think spines are so cool too, because good players miss right and left. They don't miss numbers.
Yeah, it's true.
So a spine all of a sudden to the right and left of the pin, that you could hit a shot to 15 feet and have a really tough little putt.
There are so many holes around the world that you look at that the play is dictated by a single feature, generally, most or so often at a green. Fourth green at the old course at St. Andrews, a little knob. The little mound that sits out there just short of the fourth green. That particularly for good players. Well, it starts like as soon as we hit a tee shot, oh man, we'll have to deal with that thing. And it's that type of thing. You know, and I think the better the player is, the more they're influenced by small things rather than large things, because it can be the biggest bunker in the world. Most good players aren't worried about sitting over, or if there's enough room to the side, they can avoid it. But it's the smaller things. One of the things I've learned so much from Ben through all the years is how little things do affect the best players in the world. You know, a certain tilt of the ground in combination with a certain wind angle can make things easier or more complicated, more difficult. A good player. So it's often the little things that are as important as the big. And I think so often people look at golf courses and focus on the big picture and sometimes miss the detail.
Yeah, so it's the little things that, like, it's like what we talked about before about, you know, the difference between the what people were trying to mimic die with, but they miss the little details inside of it. Pete, it might look the same.
Exactly. Pete was a master at making small elements work and influence play. Mm-hmm. And sometimes those will get lost, I think, in the picture that was presented.
So we'll go to Joe Estes, who little bit of history is A.W. Tillinghast's great-grandson. he wanted to ask, you've built so many great courses. What are you still learning at your most recent projects and that you didn't know before? Like, you know.
All right, Joe. It's, first of all, Joe, I'd have to say, my partner, Ben Crenshaw, is such a huge fan of your great-grandfather. If you ask Ben, you know, what his favorite architects are, I mean, Perry Maxwell's going to be up there because Ben grew up on the Perry Maxwell golf course, too. Mm-hmm. So he and I are both going to be in agreement with that. But he will almost immediately go to A.W. Tillinghast. And which is, from my perspective, completely understandable. And probably from the perspective of building golf courses that can strategically and interestingly challenge the very best players in the world, even today on courses that were built many decades ago, I would have to think he would be at the absolute top.
It is amazing to look at his course directory and how they stood the test. That whole Philly school.
Oh, it's incredible. It's just incredible. But I guess to your question, you know, it just seemed like there was a cliche or something once said that when you quit learning, you're dead or something to that effect. I don't know. But, yeah, I think each one of our projects, I think we learn from what we've done and then observing what we've done. We obviously learn from what other people have done. Mm-hmm. There's no question. You have to do that. But even in our small little realm, we observe what we've done. We observe when it worked, when things worked, when they didn't, and how do we try to get interesting presentations of interesting sites, but do it in such a way we minimize the things that don't work and maximize the things that we've learned that do. So I don't know that I can give you an absolute example of that, other than it becomes cumulative. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing becomes cumulative in the sense that so many decisions when you're creating a golf course, so many decisions become pure judgment calls. Mm-hmm. You can try to base them on statistics, and you can try to do this and that and the other, but the difference in the very best architecture and some of the very worst is not that far removed. And you want to walk down the line, and you want to make it as interesting as it can be, and at the same time not cross over the line and somehow you just fall into goofiness. Mm-hmm. And that may sound weird, but it can be a pretty fine line to walk. I mean, if you look at the greens at Wingfoot, let's say, and you go, Mr. Tilling has a pretty damn good idea of what was going to work and what wasn't. And yet it's on the line, man. It's walking on that line. And so you go, we often look at stuff, whether it's like there or in Oakmont, and going, could we ever build these greens? First of all, I think Ben would agree with me. I don't think either of us think that we're so proud of the guys that we work with. We're prejudiced. We happen to think they're the best. Yeah. But at the same time, when you see things like the contours of the greens at Oakmont, or you go to Wingfoot, and you just see things. Somerset Hills. Mm-hmm. You go look at the greens at Somerset Hills, and you go, are you kidding me? Who thought of this? How did he think of this? Mm-hmm. And it works. And yet, you could easily try to mimic some of that, those contours within green, within putting surfaces, and fail miserably.
Yeah.
And they'd be tearing them all up and redoing them within a year. So it's those judgment calls. How do you make them? And how do you approximate the best that's ever been done in terms of creativity and still making it work?
This It is a fine line. Jared Klein, who used to work at Sandhill, had a question along the same lines. It kind of led, leads perfectly into it. If you could redo any hole or stretch of holes at your courses, would you do it? And if you would, where would it be?
Well, we have done it. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have done it. Good to hear from you, Jared, too. Hope all's well. I haven't talked to you in a while. So I like Jared a lot. He's very talented guy. You know, again, we do the best we know how to do with each given site and each given opportunity to build a course. That doesn't mean we get it right. We try, but we're very much aware, and particularly on some sites that are pretty severe, that you think something's, you know, you put the first presentation out there, think this is the best we know how to do on this, and then you watch it, and you watch people play it over a period of time, and then if you believe, you sincerely believe, you can refine something or make something better, make it more playable or make it more interesting for more than just one class of golfer. Mm-hmm. You don't just look and say, how do we make this tougher for the college players or the tour players or something? How could we do something? Could we do something here that would influence, make this more interesting for the members or the resort players or the guests or the best players in the world, whatever. Can we do this? Can we accomplish that and make it more interesting? That's when you make a move. And, or when something just simply, you know, just think, well, we did the best we could at the time. Mm-hmm. And now, hindsight being proverbial 2020, we probably should have done something a little different. We've been fortunate in not having a huge number of those situations, but I was just, Dave Axon and I were just at East Hampton Golf Club just a month ago, and the little drop shot par three hole there, the 17th, it was number 8 when we originally did it, they switched the 9s with a little downhill, just a little pitch down the hill to a plateau green. Part three, the green was that we built is simply too severe for the green speeds they maintained, and too, and for, you know, it just didn't work well. Did it work? Yes, it worked. The members seemed to have embraced it for years now. I've been talking to the folks at East Hampton about, could we just go soften those contours? We can maintain the relationship. So it's not like the green's gonna look dramatically different or anything. It just, can we just make it a little more pinnable and playable and just a little more fun. And the folks at East Hampton, and they were very happy with it the way it was. Mm-hmm. But this year, enough sand had built up from the bunker, you know, coming out of the bunkers around the rim of the green, and it had started to really constrict some things. They said, we should probably fix this. So at the same time, we softened the contours a little bit. And then they just reseeded the green, away we go.
So, most people probably didn't even notice.
Well, they won't see it till next season, but yeah. Yeah, it's still got, you know, it's got the little upper left shelf and the little kind of middle upper thing in the back center and the little dippy thing in the front pin. And so it, but we study these things, and we by no means believe that our first attempt at anything is going to be the way it should absolutely be.
It's a good way to look at everything in life.
I think, Andy, the thing for us is we love to maintain connection with the courses that we've done and then watch how they progress. And sometimes, you know, there can be some outcry against some element of the golf course. And we resist saying, okay, let's go change that. let's see how it goes for a while. Because sometimes something, particularly if it's something different, may not be the most positively received, but over a period of time, it becomes appreciated. And so we like to give it time. And then if we maintain the, you know, the connection with the course, and we get together with the owners or the members, the bodies may be that, you know, that take care of the on the course, take care of the course, and we say, okay, could we do something here that might make it a little more interesting, a little more playable, or whatever the case may be. So the courses we like, and you're the ones that we do the best we know how to do. Mm-hmm. And yet, we're probably aware that they haven't reached their potential, because that potential needs to be gained through stewardship and management over a period of time. Mm-hmm. And seeing how they play, and then seeing things that they need some alterations, big or small, to get closer and closer to their potential. So we like seeing the courses that progress, maybe not dramatically, but quietly, mm-hmm. upward.
Yeah. It's so many courses go the wrong way over time. It's really great to see it go the right way over time.
Yeah, it is.
I got this question from a couple youngsters in various ages, but advice for young people who want to become architects who have studied the concepts. But, you know, what would be your advice for a 19 or 17-year-old that, you know, at this point in their life wants to become a golf course architect?
Well, my first advice is have a plan B, a serious plan B. I guess it's easy for me sitting here at this point in my life, but I remember Pete Dial those years ago when we mentioned earlier about him lying on the bed watching the Dolphins game. And I said something about I'd like to, you know, I'd kind of like to say, this is done. I might want to be a golf course architect. I remember he just flippantly, said, oh, it's only becoming a golf course architect about the same as being struck by lightning. You know, and then he was right back to TV. And, you know, that's not the most encouraging, you know, advice, but it's not that far off. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really, and particularly in today's economic world, and it's not that it can't happen. If you have a dream to do that, I would say choose every possible avenue to pursue that dream, and yet make sure there is a serious plan B backup. I would say that to people who are looking at golf architecture. I would absolutely say it to people who think they're going to play golf for a living. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of great players out there. You better have plan B. And so now, having said that, I would study golf courses as much as I possibly could, see as many different ones as they could. I would not necessarily just fall in line and say, oh, this is, here's so-and-so's ranking of courses. This has got to be really good. It's in the top, whatever. Go make your own judgments. See enough different things to decide yourself. Do I like this? And if you do, why? Do I not like this? Why? Don't make those judgments on how you played that day if you play. Make them upon why don't you like it or why do you like it. Have to put up a reasonable defense of your position. Mm-hmm. And by, you know, you may see a golf course that's not on anyone's ranking of anything and think it's better than maybe the one that's the highest rank on any ranking you see. That's okay. That has merit, that idea of thinking, I appreciate this course more. Just get to the point you understand why you appreciate it. And then if you got put in the position to defend it, how would you defend it? So Beyond that, I would also say, if you're able to do it, if your financial situation is such, or if you can survive on extraordinary and minimal finances and that sort of thing, you don't have a family you're responsible for, then go get engaged in the business of building these things. Start at the ground. Mm-hmm. Starting at the ground is not fun, but start, if you have to, as a laborer with a maintenance crew on a golf course, then a construction crew. Find out how these things get built, and then interact, if possible, with the people who are making the decisions as to how they're being built, and then, if possible, with people who are making the decisions how they're being designed. And just get engaged in the process. I mean, if you can learn how to do that and get a sense of what actually occurs, because we all have the theory. We can all study the books, and we can all come up with the talking point. But when push comes to shove, as they say, how do you get it done? Mm-hmm. And you can talk about risk and reward, and you can talk about all the strategy. You can talk about all these things all you want to. You make the most beautiful sketches with how you get it done on the ground. That's a whole nother thing. And I remember Pete telling me many years ago, too, he said, one thing you have to learn, you've got to understand how to talk to the guy on the machine. That's another cutting through to the most simplistic way of saying, communicate. You've got to understand. If you're expecting something to happen in terms of contour, how do you get that message through? And if you know how to do it yourself, if you're physically capable of running a piece of equipment and creating something yourself, it's a huge advantage. Because even if you're struggling to communicate to somebody else, you can show an example. This is what we're talking about. This is how, and you start to build those relationships with the people who are making it happen. And it works the other way, because when they realize you, first of all, have been willing to do that, and secondly, understand a bit of what they're going through, that respect and appreciation is going to increase dramatically, and the communication is going to be much, much better. So I've said to our guys, you know, we've got guys that have worked with us for years who go off and do their own designs, and they're just doing some absolutely beautiful stuff. But they're able to do it because they're also, not only they can think about the design, the theory, the strategy, the risk reward, they're able to get it done on the ground. Mm-hmm. So particularly at some of these lower budget golf courses, which they're going to be more and more of those as time goes by. But when those courses, if you have the ability to literally create your ideas yourself on the ground, mm-hmm. you have a huge head start, because then a lower budget situation says, well, I get this guy, he designed it, but he can also make it happen and work with the guys. Now, years ago, that was very difficult to do because you were either a designer or you were
a builder.
Constructor or a builder or something. So the design build thing back many years ago was, you know, I'll say it wasn't looked upon so favorably, but it's absolutely the way of the future.
Yes, I say that all the time. I also say if you find these young, like especially any municipality that's looking to do anything, and you don't have a budget that's that big, like get somebody that's A, uber talented, but B, can do all the work. And
it's absolutely right, Andy. I mean, you know, two of the guys who worked with us, Keith Rapp and Riley Johns, what they did at Winter Park, a little nine-hole course down there in Far Egypt, they did the most beautiful job. And it was a situation, there simply was not a budget. If they'd hired a, quote, name designer or something, there went their whole budget. Mm-hmm. Or if they, you know, if they didn't, they'd have a contractor after a builder. And believe me, I have great admiration for golf course builders. They do fabulous work. But there's sometimes you just got to have a little bit of both. Mm-hmm. And to make it happen, and there's a prime example. And Dave Axon and Dan Proctor, who worked with us, and they went out there to Wild Horse,
yeah,
in Gothenburg, Nebraska, in a tiny little town in the, you know, the edge of the sand hills there in Nebraska, and they built us this 18-hole golf course. Must have been 15 years ago or so. It's still considered one of the best public golf courses in America.
And less than $50 a play.
Yes, and I think it may be considered the best, very low price point golf course in America. That's and true. It's because they worked with contractor and they worked with construction people doing it, but they designed it and helped build it themselves,
yeah,
with the assistance of the golf course contractor.
If you think about the logic of it, if you hire an architect who hires a contractor, two businesses are making a profit off of it. If you hire an architect that builds, one business is made. Like, you know, like everybody's making a profit. Yeah. You know, like you wouldn't be in business, like in, but you're taking one, and then also the communication, the whole idea is there's one less person. And you know, how much easier is it for you to make a decision than it is for you and your wife to make a decision? You know, the simplest term.
Well, fortunately, we're pretty good about that, so it's not that big a difference for you. But yeah, I understand completely what you're saying.
We do this overrated, underrated segment. So I give you, this is the last thing we're doing. I give you a topic and you have to, overrated or underrated, there's no properly rated. So we're gonna start with Ben Crenshaw's putting.
I would say it's underrated. I mean, I've watched Ben now for, he and I have been business partners for, it's going to be 32 years next month. It's just incredible. It's hard to believe. But, you know, I've watched Ben from the time he was absolutely one of the very best players in the world. And probably recognized as the best putter in the world. Mm-hmm. And to today, where he by his own admission would not call himself one of the better players in Austin, probably, versus much less in the world. So, and yet, even to this day, his ability to roll a golf ball on a putting surface is just a thing to behold. He does it time after time. Just the ability to visualize a line and get the proper speed, and then to get the ball to just roll over and over toward the hole, and almost invariably will end up either touching the hole or being extremely close to it. And you see it so often, you just take it for granted. And it just, you know, we were talking some earlier about people who are truly extraordinary at what they do make it look so easy, even you believe you can do it.
Yeah.
And so I've looked at this for years and go, oh, I can do that. Well, it doesn't quite work out that way. You know, and so I don't know that Ben would agree with this, but 3 years, Ben has extraordinary eyesight, even to this day.
Mm-hmm.
And I truly believe that that is a part of his. He can see the movement of grass and things on putting surfaces in a way that I've never seen anyone else. And he, you know, I truly believe that's part of it. And of course his incredible touch, his ability to just roll a ball on the proper line at the proper speed. And it's so as much as he's been touted as being one of the world's, if not the world's, best putters, I think his reputation is understated.
I bet that putter's cost you a few matches over the years.
Fortunately, Ben, I don't play for anything other than fun. So, I can't. I mean, we just start off, it's a given who's going to win. So, we go from there.
There's nothing worse than playing against a guy that went anywhere within 25 feet. You're just utterly terrified that the ball's going to go.
Yeah.
Almost expecting.
It looks like almost everyone's going to go along with it.
Overrated, underrated, blind approach shots.
Overrated meaning they're perceived as as bad?
Yeah, just in general, you know, are they? I guess go with the public perception as your basis.
Well, the public perception, I think, would be that that's a negative.
Yeah.
Even blind approach shots. I personally believe, and I think Ben agrees with this, that in certain situations, you can't have anything more fascinating than a blind approach over the hill and get to top the hill and look down there and see where did it go. Mm-hmm. And if the contours allow you to play certain shots, and maybe you get the ball, you know, perhaps near the hole, even on a blind shot, I think those are extremely interesting situations. Now, you don't want to just overdo it.
Yeah.
You know.
It's variety.
It's variety. So, if you, from our perspective, if we're laying out a hole and the second shot is over the hill to a green, you don't see it, we will very, very seldom knock down the hill to where you can see it.
Mm-hmm. 200 yards and longer par threes, overrated or underrated?
I think there was a time, Andy, that again, I'm a little struggling with the overrated and underrated, but I'd be more, is that a good thing or a bad thing? We've built a lot of long par threes. Mm-hmm. I guess partly because Ben and I both grew up on courses that had, you know, usually one really long par three. There was a belief, you read the old golf architecture books, there was a belief that was a part of the game. Your ability to play a wood shot into a par three in order to exhibit that skill, the accuracy as well as the distance into a par three hole was a significant part of the game. I think it's harder to do these days because the distance the ball goes and everything. You know, it used to be a 215 or 20 yard hole was just extraordinarily long, and it was a wood shot.
Yeah.
You know, and now it's a
seven iron.
And so you go, really? So are we going to build 280 yard par threes? We're going to build 300 yard par threes? That's when I think it starts to get, I start to question. So I think the change in the distance the ball goes has changed that equation dramatically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was reading Don, I think it was Don Ross's book, and there was a quote that was like, the skill, the truest test of skill is the long iron game.
Yeah.
And it's so sad that now
there are no long irons.
It's not as driving a wedge.
Yeah.
For all these, I saw Dustin Johnson, the long, he had one iron shot into a par four longer than a seven iron last year.
Yeah.
One.
Yeah.
The whole year.
Oh, that's incredible. Yeah, I'm actually not surprised. I mean, it was, you know, you were talking about the Warren course in Notre Dame. I was up there about 3 weeks ago, I guess. We were doing a few little bunker tweaks and things for the senior open. And they were playing a collegiate tournament there that day. And there were some good teams there, but it wasn't like the best college teams in America. And yet, I was just fascinated watching some of these young guys. I mean, it just one after another, after another, after another. They were hitting the ball. I happen to know how far they were hitting because we'd been measuring to some of these bunkers, and you'd have to stand there and wait from the hip. We weren't working that particular day, but had to wait for them. So just measuring everything. They were hitting the ball 295 to 305 in the air.
Yeah.
In the air. And you go, and then some of them, beyond. But it was like, really? Really? That's, so when you do that, how long do you have to make the hole to not have a seminar?
Yeah. It's unsustainable. And then the problem is that the distance advantage has gotten so high for the great players, and it hasn't really gotten that, you know, that it hasn't equally moved for the regular player.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's the biggest problem.
Absolutely. One of the golf writers called me late last year about Trinity Forest, and he said, Bill, so they're going to play the Byron Nelson there next year. I mean, in 18. And he said, so what have you and Ben done to combat the huge advantages of the players have today with distance? And I know the man thought I was just being, maybe he thought I was being disrespectful. I don't know. I wasn't. But I just said, well, in general, we've made the course shorter and wider. And there's just this pause on his tongue. What? I said, I don't mean that to sound probably as, you know, probably the way it probably came across. I said, but it's true. I said, we haven't worried about length. We haven't tried to make the holes. I said, first of all, it's on 140 acres, Trinity Forest. It's on a landfill. You can't drop off the sides of the landfill. You're confined. You can't make their holes. You just can't make them any longer. So we weren't out there trying to say, how do we make this longer and longer and longer? He was like, we're going to make fairways wide enough to have to choose a line.
Yeah.
Choose the wrong line. The longest players better choose a proper line, or they'll go through the fairway into something they might not like. So they have to choose the lines. And then, so we're adding width. Mm-hmm. And then, even a little bit shorter, a lot of holes. Because generally speaking, the guys seem to struggle the most with distance control.
Yeah.
It's not, can you hit it far enough over something?
Yeah.
Almost everybody can do that. Can you hit it precisely enough someplace? And with the contours of the greens being such that you need to land your ball properly, either short of a contour or over a contour or that sort of thing, if the turf is firm, then we feel like that's what we're doing. It also provides interest for the members and their guests. But yeah, we're not out. First of all, we don't really do tournament courses, but we do courses that sometimes they play tournaments on. And so we'll see.
It reminds me of the eighth hole at Sandhills. I hit the pin was right above the bunker, so Lion's Mouth Green, for those that short par four. And I hit a drive the first time around of the day, right down the middle, smoked it. I hit like 30 yards in it, and I stood there and I was like, oh, I'm in the very worst spot you can be. Like, the absolute worst, 30 yards, right down the middle. And then the next time around, I made sure to hit it as far left, or I went left, as far left as I could with the driver so I could have the angle in. Yeah. And that's going to be the fascinating thing about watching it. It's going to be a completely different style of golf. So last overrated, underrated. Get you out of here. I gotta get home tonight.
Yeah.
Pebble Beach.
I don't know, Andy. I'm a huge admirer of Pebble Beach. Do I think it's the best golf course I've ever seen in the world? No. Mm-hmm. Is it extremely interesting? Yes. Is it extremely inspiring? Yes. I guess in that case, I would almost have to look at an individual ranking and say, I think it's overrated or underrated to see. But just to just pick it in general out there, I don't know. Or the
position. I don't know what the rating is either, so.
Yeah. So I would say generally it's probably underrated.
Underrated. That's a lot of great golf holes.
Yeah.
This is, it's that, I always I think about that. You see the old photos of that place.
Yeah.
That's what
I know. It's you know.
Yeah.
I mean, am I partial to Cypress Point? Yes. You know, this, but that doesn't mean that I don't think Pebble Beach is not extraordinary.
What about Paso Tiempo?
I've never seen Paso Tiempo.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I've never seen it, so I have no... I've seen photographs of it, you know, early on, and then later after Jim Urbina and Tom Doak, you know, worked there.
Oh, yeah, I was there last week, and it's the latest corpse that's, you know, just stuck in my head.
Yeah.
It's one of most recent.
I can't imagine it's not really good since McKenzie lived there.
It's the back nine is something else, and, you know, you look at that, and it's, they have 40,000 rounds a year. So there are certain things there that, and I think this is always something that gets lost, is that certain places can't be what other places are. And
right.
It doesn't mean that they're worse.
No.
It just means that this is the issue. But if you took that course and it was a 10,000 round exclusive club, and you could, I mean, it would be out of this world.
Yeah.
But it is so good. Everybody, I mean, I love the model that they have there too, in terms of what. But yeah, enough of me. You gotta go see Pasadena.
Yeah, at some point.
It's gotta be on the bucket list.
Yeah, at some point.
But thank you so much for the time. This was.
You're welcome, man.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Thanks for enduring the brutal cold today.
That was.
And for walking around the par 3 course, that was fun.
That was an enduring cold. Yeah. That was fun. Yeah. So, thanks again.
Okay, very well. Until next time.